Can everybody hear me way in the back and all? All right. I hope you enjoyed your meal tonight. The Sheraton has a new chef for the last couple of years, and I think it's been a great improvement. So if you haven't had a chance already, you can sneak over to the back table and get dessert and a hot drink, if you so choose. I'm Mary Ellen Robertson, put a lot of this stuff together with the help of many hands. I wanted to say thank you to all of the people who have been volunteers this year with the symposium. Up until this very evening, we've had a lot of people helping out and helping me stay sane. It's been really great. That includes the Sunstone staff, Carol Quist, who keeps us all on course, Holly Welker, who was my assistant this summer, and was very essential to getting all the preparations to run smoothly, and also Stephen Carter, who lends his design expertise to the symposium program that you've all been looking at for the past few days. It tends to have his excellent design touch.
And the t-shirts.
Oh, and the t-shirts. He did our new Octosun design t-shirts, if you saw those at the registration table. I would also like to thank our board members, and special thanks to those who donated to the cake and gelato fund for the refreshments we had Wednesday night at our opening lecture. That was a special treat for all of us. And I would especially like to thank my husband, Michael Stevens, who's talking to his mom and not listening.
I'm sorry, did you say something?
I wanted to say a special thank you to him for all of his efforts in directing the AV team. It really takes a village to put together an event this size, and I'm really not the technically inclined among the villagers, and so we rely on some really dedicated volunteers who take time off work to toil away in a back room, and they get to hear sessions as they edit them for us to put on CD and upload to our website later on, but they don't get to be in on the fun stuff that happens in the session rooms, and so we especially thank all those who toil in the background without people really knowing they're there and how much they help us. So we'd like to thank them. I'd also like to give special thanks to the people who provided funds for Sunstone Registration Scholarships. This is a new thing that we did this year. I have a birthday in July, and there's a fundraising application through Facebook called Facebook Causes. And so I announced that for my birthday, I would be thrilled if people would donate money to help fund registration scholarships for people who, you know, for whom money was a little tight this year and they couldn't afford to pay for the symposium on their own. And the funds that came in through Facebook Causes and from other sources allowed 18 people to attend the symposium this year, either as a full scholarship to cover their registration, to cover student registration if funds were tight for them, and I also gave away 3 packs of individual session tickets on Facebook for the people who were up late one night when I was thinking, how do I distribute the rest of the funds? So some people lucked out and won their way into a few sessions of Sunstone, and I thought that was really successful and a great way to give back to the folks who would love to be here, but were a little constrained from doing that. Since Sunstone's a nonprofit, you know, we rely on the generosity of our supporters, and I just wanted to let you all know, you may have seen our giving tree hanging in the lobby, and I just wanted to say that any donations made to Sunstone during the month of August are eligible for having matching funds given by a couple of generous donors. So any contribution made to Sunstone is doubled, essentially, this month. So if you didn't have a chance to buy an ornament and stick it on the giving tree, it's not too late to have your donation eligible for matching. All right, I will go ahead and introduce the panelists for tonight. The title of tonight's session is LDS Women in the 20th Century, Witnesses to a Changing Church. It says America here, but I think it was Changing Church. Claudia Bushman is the project director and adjunct professor of Mormon studies at Claremont Graduate University, with degrees in literature and American studies from Wellesley College, Brigham Young University, and Boston University. Her 12th book, Pansy's Family History, will be published this summer. Another panelist, Lisa T. Clayton, is a resident of Newport Beach, California. She has a BA in English from the University of Utah and is a master's candidate in religion at Claremont Graduate University. It was school when I went there. It's hard to get out of my head. She manages the Newport Beach Oral History Collaborative. Lauren Kennard is one of our, did I say that right?
Kennard.
Lauren Kennard is from Midvale, Utah. She is a graduate of Southern Virginia University and is currently an MA candidate at Claremont Graduate University. She hopes to study abroad in the near future. And weren't you also thinking about chaplaincy? Yes. Investigating, going into chaplaincy. Caroline Klein, another panelist, is a resident of Irvine, California, and is a graduate of Scripps College with an MA in Classics from UC Santa Barbara. She is the co-founder of the Exponent 2 blog and plans to begin a PhD program in Women's Studies in Religion in Claremont Graduate University this fall. And we have one replacement panelist. One of the original A-team wasn't able to be here this evening, and so Claudia will go ahead and introduce who is speaking in her stead. And with that, I will relinquish the microphone to our esteemed speakers tonight.
It is my very great pleasure to introduce you to the Claremont Oral History Program this evening, sponsored by the Howard W. Hunter Chair of Mormon Studies at Claremont Graduate University, and also by the Singer Foundation. This project is just a little over 1 year old. I began it informally May before last with a couple of friends and my relatives, and then in September we moved it into class. We brought in a couple of narrators, as we call it, and had the students begin to try their hands at interviewing these people. And so we then had multiple interviewers, and we began to carry on multiple interviews and transcriptions at once. These interviews are quite extensive, and the transcriptions are very demanding and labor-intensive. But at this point, we have 65 completed interviews. We have 65 signed and dated statements that tell the stories of contemporary Mormon women, that validate ordinary Mormon lives. And we have many more in the works. We have set up cells in various places where more interviewers have been recruited and more interviews have been done. I used to say that our project was growing like the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, but I've decided that that's an unfortunate simile, seeing as they've capped that well, and we want the oil to continue to flow. So, We have connections all over, and we don't plan to stop. And if you would like to be connected, if you would like to run a cell, if you would like to write your own interview, if you would like to interview someone else, let us know. Give me your name and all your contact information, or give it to anyone here, and sign up with us, tell us what you would like to do, and we'll try and work with you. Now, just a year after beginning, our second year with a number of these finished interviews, they wouldn't seem like much, but these interviews, as I say, and I am emphasizing, are all transcribed, reviewed, corrected, and edited. We have these people. We hope to have surpassed our first goal of 100 by February 5th, when we will have a big conference at Claremont. Chieko Okazaki, who, as you all know, has been inimitable in using her own life story as a lesson guide for the people that she talks to, will be our guest keynote speaker, and you're all invited to come and hear her and other wonderful presentations, and we will also make a couple of exciting announcements on that occasion. Now, in the interviews, our subjects are invited to speak on three topics: on their own biographies, on their attitudes, on LDS women's issues, and on their experience in the church. These are very open interviews. We try not to lead our narrators. We are not trying to get them to spill out any deep, dark secrets. We want these interviews to stand as general statements of the individuals and their time. After the transcriptions, the finished transcriptions are sent back to the narrators to review, and they not only correct and clarify, but they have full rights to cut out anything they wish they hadn't said. Sometimes they do. And they can also add any afterthoughts. And this gives us, they give us then, non-exclusive permission to use the typescript, but they also have full rights to use it in any way that they wish. In fact, we are writing their stories for them. For our current purposes, we use the material anonymously. You will see how we do it tonight. We're less interested at this point in who said these things than we are that they were said at all. Our general aim is to hear what women have to say. How do we choose our narrators? What are our criteria? People always want to know that. A Mormon connection is required. But the interviewers choose their own subjects, or they take the recommendations of others. One of our people interviewed a friend who was soon to have an operation. The friend's mother came to take care of her, and while she was there, they interviewed her. That's the way it carries on. No one knows all these people. I probably know more than anybody else, but no one knows them all. And we don't require any particular age or faithfulness or achievements or fame. We have converts, we have inactives, we have singles, we have divorcees, ethnics, we have beauty queens and CEOs, as well as Salt Lake, East Bench, Temple Mormon types. What we want to do is to hear from and record all sorts of women. Why are we doing this project? It results from a long time wish to conceptualize the women of the LDS Church in the 20th century. We're now well into the 21st, but we have not yet told the story of women in the 20th. It remains a great, exotic, tropical island in a faraway sea, and we need to explore it. We can easily find a great deal of prescriptive literature telling us what Mormon women should do and be. Much less tells us what they think, where they have been, and what they want. In the church, women have always been the silent majority. Well, what can we say about the 20th century? In church terms, the time was bracketed at the beginning with Utah statehood, the end of polygamy, assimilation into the United States, and the end of the gathering. The end of the 20th century was marked by huge church growth, simplification and correlation, some globalization, achievement at very high levels of government, business, and the arts. The 19th century represented the Restoration, pioneer, and Americanization experiences. The 20th century represented playing the American game and the international game. All these developments have tremendous implications for women, but they do not tell the female story. The female story is not of the institutional church. It is not the leadership or the priesthood story. It is something else, another story, one often unheralded and unrecorded. That is the story for which we are gathering information. So, where do we find the story of the LDS woman? Her life is more familial than institutional. She has her own organizations, but those do not circumscribe her life any more than does the general church structure. Her beliefs may well be deep and emotional rather than intellectual, so doctrine is not necessarily the way to find her. Her life may be supportive rather than as a leader, and there is no one she. There are many overlapping she's over 100 years. How can we begin to get at this female experience? Well, of course, we have to look to find original documents and memoirs to find how people really felt about the big events. A long story that went over a significant period, studded by well-known events which need to be put into context. And we also need to create new documents. Hence this program. Since I began this project May before last, I've done an interview every month and transcribed it. And I cannot tell you what happy labor this project has been. And I think I speak for many of the others involved. Our sisterhood has developed. We are closer in every way. We share new things. We have a process and a procedure that carries us through the difficulties in a reasonable way. We're collecting material that would be irretrievably lost in a very few years. We're helping people gather aspects of their lives that they can use in many ways. We have signed and dated statements. We are spinning straw into gold. Well, it is my great pleasure to introduce, you've already heard good introductions from Mary Ellen, but here my people are. This is Lisa Thomas Clayton, this one, and then next to her is Emily Clyde, who will be substituting for Bethany Saunders tonight. And I wanted to say about Emily, who lives in Emily Clyde Curtis, who lives in Arizona, that she is the new co-editor of the new Exponent 2, and that her other co-editor is Amy Hickman, who's there. So let's have you two just stand for a second. And here it is. It looks like this. And I understand it's been available at Sunstone, and do not leave Sunstone without it. This is a new publication you want to be in on the ground score. Okay. All right, so that's Emily. After her comes Lauren, and then after her, Caroline Klein. I would tell you more about them, but Mary Ellen's already done a good job. So I will just say, ladies, you're on.
Genesis chapter 1, verse 28. And God blessed them. And God said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth.
When it was time to have the baby, we went off to the maternity home. Natural childbirth was prescribed, and I hoped I was ready for it. I don't remember much of the birth itself. The midwife was like Juliet's nurse, a very strong, earthy woman. She knew her business, and I did survive. I also had a handsome new son.
Finally, the child was born, such a tiny little baby. The doctor held him head down, feet up, and gave him a hard spank on his little bottom. Our baby gasped for air and let out his first wail. When this little one was placed in my arms, I can't describe the joy that filled my whole being. What an outpouring of love. The happiest day in my life was the day our son was born. Now life had a purpose. We had a son to raise. Raising children was a serious business.
commandment to be fruitful is central to the teachings of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Women who subscribe to the principles of the restored gospel make choices regarding their fertility within this doctrinal context. But principles must be applied and interpreted. In our oral histories, we see both variety and progression in the interpretation of the stated doctrine and in the application of these principles. Our oral histories are filled with reflections on these principles and stories of their applications. We will look first at our narrator's attitudes towards pronouncements from authoritative church sources, then examine how they viewed local authorities' advice, as well as friends' and families' input. Finally, we will hear the challenges that infertility brings. The LDS doctrines of eternal family and eternal progression may seem ethereal and distant, but their application begins in the very first days of marriage. Decisions must be made. Principles are interpreted and put into practice, the result being the lived religion of these women. As they sail the perilous seas between earth and heaven, we hear in their histories that they take this matter seriously. We will hear today how they navigated these waters. The women in our project experienced their childbearing years as participants in a consistently pro-family religion. The oldest of our narrators, now those in their 80s, began having children in the late 1940s, before reliable birth control was available. Our younger participants, those now in our younger ones that have had children, those now in their 40s, were having children in the 1990s. This was 30 years after the upheaval of the sexual revolution. Society's attitudes towards birth control, family, gender relations, and sex itself have changed dramatically in the course of these 50 years. These were choppy waters.
50 years ago, it was different. Women had no care about how many children they had because we didn't have birth control. So fertility was an issue that came much later. The only thing was that some women felt that they should have more children because there were souls in heaven that needed to come. The rest of us just took what came and were glad to have them.
Historically, LDS teachings explicitly discouraged any use of birth control. As late as the 1970s, church news editorials, devotional addresses, and private pastoral counseling often urged women to make top priority having children, even it seemed to many when it compromised their health or emotional well-being. Some seemed to drown in the sea of expectations. Tonight, we will not trace the specific church declarations, but rather we will look at how our narrators processed these various opinions, including church input, as they applied in their lives. Our narrators were interpreters within a worldwide church and within their local personal circumstance. We will look at what they considered legitimate sources of influence as they navigated their way.
When I was first married in the 1950s, the use of birth control pills was just beginning. It seemed to me that every Sunday on the editorial page of the church news, there was an article reminding people that birth control was not approved. My first children were born in 1951, 1952, 1953, and 1954. And after that, my obstetrician said that I really ought to consider using birth control.
As to reproduction and fertility, it's funny how little I ever heard over the pulpit on that subject. Partly it's because I never went to BYU.
These two women are close in age, and they had children at about the same time. One felt compelled to have babies by church editorial decree, and the other heard little over the pulpit. Was indeed church education at BYU, as this narrator suggests, indeed the critical variable? Perhaps. Our sample size is much too small to allow us to calculate statistical trends. Our histories give us snapshots of these women's experience, and we hear their individual voices.
I do not feel that I was told by the church what I could or couldn't do with respect to family size and fertility issues. Maybe it's because we lived away from the church for those first 5 or 6 years. I was very happy with our 6 children. I'm not sure we felt like we were following the commandments of the Lord or anything. We used birth control from the time we were married. It wasn't very effective birth control.
During my lifetime, I have seen a change in what I perceive to be the church's stand. They seem to be quiet on this issue now. Long ago, I remember reading an item in the Ensign magazine, written by a church member who was a prominent obstetrician. He referred to his own daughter, who had had numerous problems with a late pregnancy and difficult health issues. She said to him, "Daddy, can I stop now?" He was taken aback by her thinking that she needed his or priesthood approval. In the article, he said, "This is up to you. This has always been up to you."
We hear these women making choices as they chart their course. Some were clearly acting in response to church councils, while others were unaware of counsel coming from church authorities. Many mentioned advice from local church authorities.
When I was going through the temple for the first time, the temple matron said, "Now, girls, you should have as many children as you possibly can. There are so many advantages to a big family, because if you buy a big head of lettuce and there are just two of you, some of that lettuce is going to go to waste. If you have a lot of children, it won't go to waste." I didn't really enjoy that first temple experience because I kept thinking back to that head of lettuce. I rebelled against what she said. I never intended to have a really large family.
Prior to our wedding, we received conflicting counsel. First, our bishop cautioned against the use of birth control and counseled us to let children come when they will. But then our stake president advised us to prayerfully seek a safe method of birth control. He thought it was wise to consider your wife's health in choosing your form of birth control. After moving to California following the birth of our first child, our new bishop was a medical doctor. He strongly recommended the use of the birth control pill. The differences in these opinions was striking. It appears to me that the church's stance on birth control has evolved. I think their counsel to married couples now intrudes less into the bedroom. We hold the institution of marriage and family in the highest regard, but responsibility lies with the couple themselves to decide upon the size of their family.
We hear themes of individual choice, of interpreting local and general church teachings, and of couples counseling together. It is interesting to note that with the exception of the temple matron, all of the official advice that these women report come from men in positions of general or local authority within the church. This fact isn't a point of expressed concern or irritation that is accepted by our narrators. We've discussed how these women viewed official church input, but what other counsel do they mention? What blend of doctrine, personal revelation, and friendly advice did they hear? Our narrators report that husbands, extended family, friends, ward members, acquaintances, and even strangers felt free to express their opinions. As our narrators share who and what influenced them in their choices, it is clear there is no one-tone, monolithic body of influence. There is diversity of input and lack of uniform opinion. This seems to create a personal and powerful space in which these women pick and choose who they allow to influence their choices.
I never had problems with anyone telling me what was acceptable or not. When I was just married, the bishop's wife told me that she used a diaphragm. When I saw this faithful member of the church who had six kids and who had spaced them using birth control, I thought it was okay.
It was always a strong belief held by many when I was having my children that birth control was bad and women should have as many children as possible to replenish the earth. When I made a decision to stop at four, I actually received criticism from my extended family. I had a family member tell me that I was not being righteous to limit my family. I was being selfish.
I often encountered disapproval from members who did not approve of my rapidly growing young family. I hated it when some man in church would make comments like offering to tell me what was causing my pregnancy. There was a general fear in the national news that the world was becoming overpopulated and that responsible citizens should limit family size.
I had expected to find reports of social pressure from ward members to have a prescribed and high number of children. Interestingly, it was more often extended family that seemed to play that role, not the ward family. As we see in the following stories, well-meaning friends and even strangers felt free to express their opinions on the topic.
I did have the unpleasant experience of being heckled on streetcars and when walking down the street when I was pregnant with my youngest in 1971 and had hold of several young children. The population explosion was big news. It was not popular to be pregnant then, but times have changed.
I remember very clearly the arrival of our first baby and the miracle of it. I remember being in this little room and feeling that this was truly a partnership between my husband and myself and the Lord. I also remember not very many weeks after having our first child that I received a zero population growth pamphlet from a fraternity brother of my husband's. It was really one of the first times I had been confronted with a real lifestyle choice making me feel somewhat irresponsible to the world if I was going to continue to have children. We chose to ignore the zero population growth movement. Interestingly enough, I never received more literature from this individual, although we always sent the birth announcements as we worked our way up to number 7.
Our narrators report distinct sources of advice and demonstrate an ability to chart their courses independently. And what about husbands? Our narrators often, and not surprisingly, describe their husband's influence on their choices. We hear the results of those negotiations as well.
I only had 3 children. My husband is an only child. I would have liked more, but I'm kind of high-strung. So he was probably right to say no. Also, I suffered when I was pregnant, and I don't think he liked to see me suffering.
I admire tremendously those of you who have big families and have done it well. I think one of the really important things for women is to know their own limitations. I know that given my particular high-strung temperament, my endurance was stressed with my 3 children. I feel very blessed that I was not pressured on that score. My husband thought that 3 children was kind of a lot.
None of our narrators so far report major disagreements with their husbands as to number of children. What we do hear influence and negotiation. I noted with interest the differences between our younger and our older narrators. Our younger women speak more often about personal agency, personal preference, and revelation regarding these choices. They demonstrate an even greater sense of personal judgment and independence. Variables influencing this shift in attitude could include their increased access to ever more effective birth control, their evolving understanding of the applicable doctrinal principles, a shift of emphasis in church teachings, and certainly feminism in society and in the church.
As far as my feelings about the church and birth control, I've always known I had my agency. I felt the church's encouragement to have children, but I never felt I couldn't make those choices about when or how to have them.
I think that the church's teaching is to have the number of kids that you can handle, not to multiply and replenish the earth at the expense of yourself, emotionally, mentally, physically. I think the church's views are changing. Are we still commanded to multiply and replenish the earth? Yes, but I think it's up to you and your husband. It's between us and our Heavenly Father.
This is one of our younger mothers. She describes a triangle of influence: God, her husband, and herself. Surely this couple was influenced by both the doctrines of the church and society's expectations, but it is noteworthy that she declares that the ultimate decision is between her husband, her conscience, and her God. We've spoken of choices regarding the limiting and the timing of pregnancy, the effort to have control over birth, but what about the loss of control that infertility brings? In bearing children, these women's choices are framed by eternal principles, but stark physical realities will modify the application of those principles. We hear the wave of anguish over lost pregnancies and the chronic ache of infertility.
I struggled with infertility and didn't have our daughter until we had been married for 8 years. I had miscarriages before and a miscarriage after her. But we were very private about that, so the perception was that I was too busy being the career woman to do the right thing. That was very hurtful.
I wanted more children. I was devastated that I didn't have more, and yet I had to be grateful that we had 4. I did have a miscarriage. It was a real feeling of personal agony when I was told that there was no life. I remember going and sitting in the car. I had 4 kids to get home to and probably somewhere to be, but I couldn't move. I felt such pain. The tears wouldn't stop. I never got pregnant again.
I've seen wonderful examples of people that have had families, and I've felt the pain of those who haven't had them, especially my daughter. It's been a very painful thing for her. I've felt her pain and her sadness at not being a mother. One time after a lot of praying and a lot of concern about it, she felt that she knew before she came to earth that she would not be able to have children. And she knew that was to be her sadness to bear in this life, and that she would have the opportunity later on. I think that has helped her, but it is sad for her and it's sad for me.
These women piloted through undesired journeys, anguished at lost potential and limitation. We see how often our narrators make reference to eternal context, even as they deal with their challenging earthly ones. They express comfort in the principle of eternal family and belief in premortal and postmortal life as they face loss and infertility here. These women, as they navigate through sorrowful times, live on earth with one eye on heaven. As I read these histories, there were some things that I expected to find that I didn't. I expected to hear a report of more in-depth doctrinal study, having studied this issue as it pertained to their choices. I expected to hear that social pressure within the ward played a role in decisions of family size, yet there was very little report of such influence. I expected to hear more frequent conflict with husbands over expectations of family size. Rather, we hear couples counseling together and forming strategies. As our session title states, these women indeed are witnesses to a changing church. And more than witnesses, they are participants as they interpret doctrine and local context and live their religion. From those interpretations, they chart their course. It is rewarding to record, read, and preserve the oral histories of these women.
Is this loud enough?
If you get close to the mic, it's loud enough.
Okay. I'll be reading Bethany Saunders' work, The Roots of Virtue, Education in the Mormon Culture. In his essay, The Training of Children, the Roman historian and commentator Plutarch emphatically states that education is the foundation of a stable society. He exhorts parents to school children at the earliest possible age so that they can be brought up to be virtuous. He writes, "In brief, therefore, I say that the one chief thing is good education and regular instruction, and that these two afford great help and assistance toward the attainment of virtue and felicity. Virtuous children can only be brought up in a society that educates them as to how the moral standards they should follow. Mormon culture has a similar understanding of the nature and importance of education. In this talk, I will use our wonderful firsthand oral histories to explore various attitudes about education among Mormon women. The four broad areas I will cover are A, attitudes towards education in general, B, experiences with higher education, C, experiences with church schooling, such as institute and seminary, and D, attitudes of women toward their children's education. First, I'd like to establish the importance of education in general among the women interviewed.
There are certain expectations of what an LDS woman is supposed to be. We are encouraged to be well-educated, to be prepared with some kind of skill to survive and support ourselves.
Several women expressed the idea that education was a priority for them and that doing well in school was a requirement in their households.
Education was important in our family, including today. In my father's family, all of his sisters went to college, which was not too common in those days. Education was also important in my mother's family, who were also from Utah. My mother was encouraged by her mother to continue on in school. She attended and graduated from high school, and usually education stopped at the eighth grade at the time.
Many women talked about the general expectation that they would continue their education beyond the required years of high school and continue on to college.
The girls I grew up with, there were four of us, who just assumed that we were going to go to college. So when it got to be time, our parents said, "Okay, you're going to have to work, you're going to have to economize, and you are going to have to scrape by, but yes, we'll send you."
In addition to the assumption that education is important, I also found that most women discuss their love of both schooling and learning.
"School, I love school. I was teacher's pet. I started in kindergarten, and I loved school. I always got A's all through grade school. My cousins will tell me, I don't remember all of this, but my cousins will tell me that when we were little, I would insist that we would play school, and I always had to be the teacher."
Another woman similarly commented that,
"I always enjoyed school. I was always a quiet, studious child in the classroom. The teachers liked having me in the class. I always did the assignments and participated and took things seriously. I found a lot of pleasure in the learning experience in school."
Many other women fondly talked about their years of schooling, mentioning favorite teachers or favorite classes. One woman talked about a teacher who truly inspired her.
"Another thing happened when I was in the ninth grade that was important to me. I took English from Mr. E, and it was in that class that Mr. E introduced us to all kinds of wonderful poetry, E.E. Cummings, Gerard Manley Hopkins, and other poets. We had to keep a poetry journal. Mr. E introduced us to free verse, modern poets, and new forms. He taught us what these poems said and how they meant. I'll always remember him for that."
In general, these Mormon women's attitudes towards education are positive. Many women talked about experiences in elementary and secondary school that shaped their desire to learn. They recalled their teachers fondly. Many of these women drew on these early educational experiences to lead them in the pursuit of higher education. The second category I will focus on is women's experiences with higher education. Most of the women in our project attended college, and several of them went on to obtain advanced degrees. Many women had only good things to say about their college experiences, which ranged from BYU to Boston and many places in between.
College was a wonderful time. We were poor as heck. We had to work hard, we lived in varying degrees of pits, and never had really nice clothes. But we girls had a terrific time. Lots of young men around. I loved my college years.
Another woman said,
I graduated from a state university. When I look back now, I'm so grateful for that wonderful institution and what I learned there. I graduated from the School of Home Economics in Child Development and Elementary Education. I think I had a minor in French. But it was a great experience, and I think I learned a lot about being a good mother because of those child development classes.
Others talked about the wonderful opportunities that college gave to them.
A lot of kids from my high school went to the same university. It was an incredible step in my life. It was a very, very fortunate thing to happen to me. Otherwise, I was pretty much destined for a church school, and that wasn't real exciting in those days. I knew that I was guaranteed to be a social failure there. So I went off and was pretty much able to support myself at university and had an incredible four-year experience there. It shaped me profoundly, but not particularly well toward being a Mormon.
Another woman talked about her desire to keep learning.
I got my Bachelor of Music in 1969, and I sang in several operas and musicals. I graduated with high distinction, and I went to graduate school, and I got a master's degree the next year. I got it in 1 year. I loved going back to school. I loved it. When I was done with my master's, I said, I'm never going to school again. But after being away from it for a few years, it was great to go back to school and be a student.
She eventually went on to finish a doctoral of music arts. For most of these women, college was not just a way to pass time before marriage, an impression that many outsiders have of Mormon women. These women found practical uses for their education, even if they did not go to work full-time. Several women commented on the skills they learned from fields such as teaching or nursing that helped them fill their roles as mothers. Those who did not go on to work full or part-time often sought advanced degrees in order to help them succeed in their chosen fields. And whether the woman was at work or a stay-at-home mom, I found that these women were passionately committed to their jobs and found them to be satisfying. The next topic I would like to talk about is women's experiences with church education. Several women mentioned attending seminary or institute, while other women received callings as primary or Sunday school teachers. And as every good teacher knows, you must learn your subject before you can teach it. I believe the nature of Mormonism promotes an interest in study of the scriptures, and the nature of callings may promote an interest in education so as to be better prepared to serve when needed. Two different women talked about memorable seminary teachers. One woman said,
I loved my second year seminary teacher. She'd been a beauty queen, and she'd lived a little. She was made a seminary teacher, and I don't think she knew hardly anything about the scriptures, so she studied every day. She gave the very best seminary lessons. She put on a Passover dinner for us all that early in the morning. She came looking like a queen every morning with the best lessons I've ever had from any teacher anywhere in the church at any time. She literally studied hours a day to be able to teach seminary to high school students. She was a lovely person.
Here we see the motif of the teacher becoming the student and in turn sparking interest in others. Another woman commented about her seminary experience.
I went to early morning seminary at first, where I was going to junior high, and then went to seminary in high school. I attended 4 years and graduated. I had a really great experience. I can remember some of my teachers, not by name, but some of them were very inspiring. At that time of the morning, they needed to be.
These women were inspired to learn more about the scriptures from their teachers, who themselves were motivated to learn so they could pass their knowledge on to others. Other women talked about the deep impression seminary left on them.
I was always raised in the church, but I don't feel like I had a really strong belief until I got into seminary in high school. I always went to seminary, and I admit, a lot of it was just to see my friends. I wasn't really highly motivated to get religious training, but that's where my friends were. It was all early morning before school, and that's where I really got my testimony, and that's where I really learned the most about the church. From then on, when I went to college, I took institute classes.
Learning about the gospel led her to deepen her faith and inspired her to continue learning at institute later in life. Several women talked about the desire to learn more about their faith so they could teach. One woman talked about teaching primary.
I never had any training or foundation in the scriptures. I taught Honesty and Joseph Smith to little 4-year-olds, but I really didn't know the scriptures. I felt like I didn't know anything about the scriptures, but it was interesting to go to class with returned missionaries and hear what they had to say.
Even though she felt she didn't know much, she was still interested in learning, not only for her sake, but for her students' sakes. Another woman talked about her current calling with Sunday school.
I've been with the teenagers for a while, the 16 and 17-year-olds. I really like it. I like that rather than just teaching the lesson in what we believe, like the stories of the Old Testament, I like to tell them the stories as if they were watching a movie. I told them about Esther very dramatically, with her wearing the equivalent of a Victoria's Secret outfit when she approached the king. I told the teenagers of this beautiful woman and the risks she took to approach the king for her people. And so to be able to give them something interesting and get them to listen, I have to make it a good story. One of the mothers actually complained. Her daughter told a friend that I was the best Sunday school teacher she ever had. And the mother wasn't crazy about me because of the way I taught the lesson, but the daughter learned more than she would have otherwise. I gave the class the story, and I think I told stories as they had never heard them before. It wasn't just a Jewish story, this was a real person in a real situation. I tried to give them something special, and I really enjoyed that.
The final category I will cover is women's attitudes towards their children's education. In general, every generation wants to see their children have more opportunities than they themselves had. For most parents, education is seen as a key component to future opportunities. One woman, talking about her own experiences, said,
"Talk about regrets in life. I hardly did any school. I threw away my opportunity for education, and I never got it back. That affected my life in the way that I raised my kids. I wanted to make sure they understood how important it was to go to school and to learn and not to throw away their opportunities. I still feel bad about that. I wish I had done more, but I didn't. I raised my girls to get an education and to have a career. Whether or not they actually work in that career was another story, but there was never any question that they would prepare themselves for life."
This woman felt bad about missed chances, and she wanted to make sure that her children would not suffer the same fate. Other women wanted to instill in their children a lifelong love of learning. They led by example.
"I think the children's interest in education is partly our example, and partly because we put money on the line to pay for it. We've never said, no, we won't pay, even when things were tremendously difficult financially. Some of those years of college took every penny we had, but we never said, no, we won't do that. We said, you may have to work to get a part-time job at school, but we never said no. I think that they would say that that was a good thing and that we have promoted education."
Yet another woman desired to provide her children with the best opportunities possible. She sent them to a good private school and was very pleased with the results.
"My children have always been very serious scholars. We've given them the best educational opportunities available. They've been given a huge boost. It made all the difference to them as scholars and learners. They were able to learn for learning's sake, the joy that comes from learning for the right reason. People ask me sometimes how to get children into Harvard, but that was honestly never our goal. We did not think of sending our children to prestigious universities. We just wanted to help them become genuine learners."
It was not just the school, but the ability to inspire a love of learning that helped her children to succeed. To sum up, the women in our study had diverse educational experiences. Some only completed as much schooling as was required, while others went on to pursue graduate or professional degrees. One thing that they all have in common is a genuine desire for learning. Whether it is knowledge for its own sake or knowledge for the sake of others, they want to learn about subjects that are important to them. This learning can take many forms, ranging from traditional schooling to seminary to personal study of the scriptures. But why is education important? As Plutarch said, education is the foundation of a moral society. Given the emphasis on morality and on personal revelation in Mormon doctrine, it is easy to see why individual study would be encouraged. The practice of education can be seen as a virtue because it is through knowledge that one can grow closer to God, and it is through knowledge that one gains the skills necessary to perform his work on earth. There is also a legacy of strong, educated Mormon women that Mormons can look back upon. The early leaders of the church, such as Emma Smith, Eliza R. Snow, Bathsheba Smith, among others, involved themselves in a variety of service activities. They organized Relief Society to be an effective agency that could provide a variety of aid to those in need. They prized knowledge as an aid to service and to revelation. It is hopeful that each new generation of women will build upon what has come before in order to shape the future of the Mormon faith.
Imagine, if you will, a cool spring night. Two college students sit on the grass near the football stadium, talking about nothing in particular. They fall into an awkward silence until one of them finally speaks. "So, we've been hanging out for a while now, right?" The other stiffens, already planning a response for the inevitable question that's sure to follow, and says, "Yeah, I guess." Then comes the moment, both dreaded and revered. "So," the first speaker plows boldly onward, "how would you define us?" The DTR, or define the relationship, is used to determine the parameters and direction of a young relationship. In a church that so heavily emphasizes marriage and family, these conversations are prevalent among Mormon singles. They become especially pertinent when one considers Elder Bruce Hafen's 1982 words to BYU students. The idea of romantic love, so commonplace that it is touched upon in virtually every book or movie or magazine, is also at the very center of the gospel of Jesus Christ. This idea was reiterated by Elder Jeffrey Holland in 2001. "Believe that your faith has everything to do with your romance, because it does. You separate dating from discipleship at your peril." Indeed, looking through my own experience as a young single adult in the LDS Church and the countless firesides and CES broadcasts I've attended, the contemporary church is vitally concerned with what President Monson labels one of the most important decisions in life: whom to marry. Reading through our oral histories, I was fascinated by how our narrators define their relationships and their search for this romantic love that Elder Hafen claims is the very center of the gospel. I was struck by three major themes in the ways that our narrators define their romantic relationships and their decisions to marry. Rather than speaking in terms of love or romance, most women define their relationships in terms of the church and the temple, attraction, or persuasion. Our first two narrators define their early relationships with their husbands in terms of their relationship to the church.
"My goal was not only to graduate from Stanford and to go on to medical school, but also to marry a Mormon man and have a family. However, the Mormon men did not want to marry a woman physician. I was bluntly told that several times. I was still thinking that I would get married and have it all. I met a man at Stanford who was a Mormon. He was pre-med and wanted to marry me, and I thought this was just the thing.
I met my husband the first week at the University of Colorado at a dance, and he was just one of the many LDS boys who were there. I was very impressed with him. He knew the gospel. We started dating and were soon engaged for 2 years. I thought because I was marrying the state president's son in the temple that my life hereafter was secure. What can you do? That's the only thing I learned in Mutual, was that you should get married in the temple. That seemed to be the final goal."
Both these women define their husbands in terms of their relationship to the church. It appears that their biggest requirements for marriage were membership in the church and a desire to go to the temple. This next narrator tells of the various men she rejected because of their lack of church commitment.
"I met a number of young men that I thought I would marry. I was engaged to a young man that I had gone through high school with, but that didn't work out. He didn't want to be active in the church and go to college and get an education. I said goodbye to that one. Then I met a young man who came from California who was in a fairly good financial situation. He was not a member of the church, but for a time we were engaged, and I thought that might turn out to be a great marriage. But as I got to thinking about it and how important the church was to me, I decided that I couldn't do that. It was a while before I met my husband."
These young men had other qualities that either qualified or disqualified them as potential spouses, such as a desire for education or the ability to earn money, but she portrays her decisions as being ultimately based on the young men's relationship to the church and her desire for a temple marriage, which she equates with the importance of the church with her. In this next story, our narrator again explains her romantic relationship with her eventual husband in terms of his church membership and activity, but puts an intriguing and uniquely Mormon spin on her decision to marry him.
"He was really cute, and everyone thought he was darling, but I told myself I wasn't interested because he was an LDS. I felt like he was safe territory to me. From the start, we'd always talk about the church, and it was like I was his missionary. We had some amazing experiences where I got to watch him go through this conversion process, and it inspired me further to go on a mission. We met in the spring and started dating, and he was baptized in July. The following February was when I decided for sure that I wanted to go on a mission. I felt like I wanted to marry him, but he hadn't been a member for a year yet, so the timing just wasn't right, even though he had already graduated, and my normal BYU co-ed, and any normal BYU co-ed would have leapt at the chance. The following August, I left on my mission. Even though I had Dear Johned him a few months before, when I got off the plane after my mission, he was waiting there with my family. During these months I had been gone, he had finally gotten his act together and had been to the temple. And when I saw him standing there with garment lines underneath his shirt, I just thought, that is the sexiest thing I have ever seen. I proposed to him 3 days later.
This narrator first speaks of their relationship in terms of converter and converted, going so far as to call herself his missionary. In fact, she refused to even consider him marriage material until after his baptism. And at one point while on her mission, she again decided that he wasn't living up to her standard of Mormonism and Dear Johned him. This then motivated him to go to the temple, leading to those sexy garment lines that eventually won her over. Our next narrator speaks of her own relationship to the church and its influence on her decision to marry. She also speaks, however, of what attracted her to her eventual husband.
Many times when I was in college were not conveniently scheduled, and the ward was quite a distance from campus. I pretty much stopped going to church. I dated a lot during my 4 years of college and eventually met the guy I ended up marrying. He was steady, kind, reliable, an engineer. Not a Mormon, not a very glamorous person, but one of the nicest persons I'd ever known. As you can imagine, my mother was very sad when I didn't marry in the church. To be honest, I'm not sure I was the kind of girl I would have wanted my returned missionary sons to date at that time. I had too many doubts and questions.
Here again, the goal of marrying a temple-going young man is set up as the standard. But instead of the young man not measuring up to this standard, this narrator defines herself as not that kind of girl. She does, however, identify what attracted her to her husband, since there had to be something other than his church membership to qualify him for marriage. This next narrator also defines her relationship in terms of attraction. She tells us what set her husband apart from the other Mormon boys. And here again, we see the influence of the church on her decision as she considers the meaning of an eternal marriage.
I married my husband when I was 27, which to some people was a little late. I really was not ready to get married before that. Even then, I felt a little nervous about the whole thing, being married in the temple forever. I dated lots of different guys, Mormons and non-members, but my husband was the first guy that I felt wasn't pretending to be stronger than he was, not acting cool. He was really just a good guy, and he liked nice things. So instead of going on a date to a church function, he would get tickets to the ballet. He was one of the first LDS guys who would take me on a real date. It wasn't just about my testimony. He wanted me to have a good time. That's what I appreciate about him.
This narrator appears to not be so concerned with the cultural expectations of the church, but rather her own expectations for a spouse. She states that he was the first LDS young man who cared about her for more than her testimony. She defines their relationship in terms of uniqueness and attraction. The following women also told their stories through the perspective of various kinds of attraction.
I met my husband at church and we struck it off. I thought, here is a man who thinks. The first thing that attracted me to him was his brain and his method of thinking about things. I had never been taught to think and analyze, but he was a thinker, a scholar. Besides that, he was tall, blonde, and handsome. So I was very attracted to him, and I guess he was to me.
This narrator defines her attraction in terms of what she learned from her husband, and therefore what she lacked, as well as physical attraction. Our next narrator also tells her story in terms of attraction and is one of the few who actually uses the phrase fell in love to describe her courtship.
One of the boys that lived across from us at BYU invited us to go to Mormon night at Disneyland, and we stayed at his house. He had a brother who had a love-hate relationship with BYU because he was such a pill and wouldn't cut his hair. He went with us to Mormon night, and I'm not kidding, we fell in love that night. It was the weirdest thing. I was totally not wanting to do that, but I really liked him. He was fun to be around, funny, and just a nice guy. We ended up staying up most of the night talking. We even talked about marriage that night. I'm telling you, I was 18 years old, and I had no interest in being married. I did not want to be one of those BYU casualties. After the weekend ended, I went back to BYU. He came up a while later, and we were still smitten. The year ended, and I went back to Seattle, and of course we kept in touch. He came to see me that summer, and we really fell in love. So I clearly didn't go back to BYU. We decided we were going to get married, and he went back to California. We finally set a date for September 1975. It was a miracle we made it to the temple worthily.
This next narrator tells her story in terms of attraction, but puts a different spin on it.
I was 28 by the time I was married, because I could not find the right one to marry. When we first met, I was not impressed with my husband at all. I thought he was just boring. When we got to the beach, I said, "Let's take our shoes off and go wading." He said no, he didn't think he'd like to do that. I thought I'd never see him again. In about a month, he called and asked if I would come down and go to the Hollywood Bowl to hear Van Cliburn play. It wasn't seeing him again, but the Hollywood Bowl and Cliburn were interesting. So I did come down. I stayed at his house. Oh, his mother. I thought he would have this kind of quiet, dowdy mother, but she was really an attractive, fun, vivacious, well-groomed woman, and his dad was a very successful attorney. They were just delightful, wonderful people. I was so impressed with his parents. After we had spent a lot of time together, I realized what a jewel he was.
I find it interesting how this woman told us first everything that she didn't like about her future husband. Only after she met his family did she start to develop an attraction for him. In this way, she begins to couch her story in terms of persuasion as well, saying that only after they spent a lot of time together, she saw what a jewel he was. These next two narrators also define their relationships in terms of persuasion.
When I first met my husband, I thought him a very stern person. He was serious, mature, no fool around. When he got home from his mission and was back to school, he began coming out to my college to see me about once a week for a study date. I never liked study dates at all. I wanted to go to concerts, to dances, and the football games. But I did very few of those after he began to visit. We studied. We tried to dance, we tried to talk, and he would go home. He began to write me letters during the week, very serious, correcting the things that I said and that I thought. His visits were somewhat painful. So when he eventually proposed to me, I was astonished. I thought he had been coming out to visit on assignment from the Elders Quorum. We did have some very nice times together after that, and I got used to the idea that I was meant to marry him, but there were still some painful times. I thought I had had a tough father, a tough and hard father, and I was meant to have a tough, hard husband. I later discovered that I was entirely ignorant of his true character. We became engaged and moved along toward marriage. I just sort of slept through the summer in a daze, not knowing what I was doing, just moving toward the inevitable.
I married a young man who was a missionary here in Southern California. His companions were a senior couple, and he would go out with the one who felt the best that day. They kind of liked me, and they kind of pushed it a little bit. So when he was ready to go home from his mission, my girlfriend and I were with this elder and the senior couple, and he dropped them off first, and then he dropped my friend off, and I thought this was highly irregular because we were not to be within arm's length of the missionaries. When they came to our house for dinner, we did not fraternize. We behaved ourselves. And so he pulled over in the middle of the road, and he said, my companions tell me what a lovely lady you are. Would you marry me? And I said, yes, elder. And I thought, you idiot, you don't even know what his name is. That evening, he went home with me and told my parents that he had asked me to marry him and that I had said yes. And my dad said, elder, it's past 10 o'clock. It's time you should be in bed. And that was it. My mother said, did you say that? And I said, yes. And she asked if I was going to marry him. And I said, I guess he's all right, isn't he? And she said, yes. But you know, I never kissed him or touched him. Then the next day, he left to go home from his mission, and he didn't come back for 3 months.
The preceding women defined their relationships in terms of persuasion and acceptance, rather than romance or attraction. This is perhaps attributable to cultural expectations. When they were young women, they likely had less power in relationships in general. A woman's ability to choose her partners and take an active role in the relationship has developed over time. A single woman, who was among the younger of our narrators, described her decision-making process this way.
My standards for whom I will marry have actually gone up the older I've gotten, because I know that I can balance my checkbook. I can pay my bills. I can make choices that take me halfway around the world and be perfectly fine. If I'm going to compromise, I don't want to lessen the quality of my life. I want it to be more than I could ever have imagined with somebody.
In general, most of the women in our project haven't defined their courting relationships in terms of romance or love. Despite Elder Haven's claims that romance is at the center of the gospel, these women often spoke practically and matter-of-factly about how they defined their relationships, not in terms of sweeping romance, but of religious expectation, multi-level attraction, and persuasion. Over the last few decades, many American denominations, including the majority of mainline Protestant churches, have made efforts to remove gender restrictions from their teachings and practices. Many of these churches now ordain women. The LDS Church, however, maintains a position that stands against this trend. Not only does it maintain its policy of male-only priesthood ordination, it also advocates clear gender roles for its members, with women often encouraged to embrace their primary role as nurturers. Simultaneously, however, Mormon leaders encourage women to seek after education and other opportunities. In 2007, President Gordon B. Hinckley told the young women of the church that the whole gamut of human endeavor is now open to women. There is not anything that you cannot do if you will set your mind to it. This sense of women's empowerment, possibility, and strength, combined with the clear gender roles that limit women's participation in the church structure, can result for some in dissonance or ambivalence about their status as women in the church. As I read these oral histories, I was particularly interested in the ways these Mormon women both A, internally dealt with or justified their restricted roles and the male hierarchy of the church, and B, how they externally acted in the face of disagreement with male leaders or with desires for expanded roles for women. First, the internal workings of women's minds as they grapple with gender roles and patriarchy. Now, most women did not emphasize in their oral histories deep struggles with these tensions that can come about for some women in an overtly patriarchal church. In fact, a lot of women were quite comfortable with the exalted rhetoric on motherhood and felt very valued in their separate and distinct roles from the men. Other women, however, in their discussion of gender roles and male hierarchy of the church, did manifest some degree of ambivalence or tension. One way some women internally dealt with this tension was to de-emphasize those gender distinctions and instead focus upon ideas of fundamental equality that the gospel teaches. When asked about women's role in the church, one woman says,
"I cling to the quote by President Hinckley in a lesson I taught many years ago. I used it and I have repeated it for years. He said, the role of a woman in the church is not to walk behind the man and not in front of the man, but by his side."
Another woman emphasizes equality among men and women when she speaks of the priesthood.
"It has never been an issue for me. If there's not a priesthood holder in the home, I can always say a prayer of my own."
This next woman, 67 years old, and thinking about the roles and expectations of women in the church, says that men's and women's core responsibilities are the same.
"I think women's primary function is to take care of their homes and families. I think men's primary function is the same. My feeling is that LDS doctrinal guidelines do not differ for men and women. I think there are different opportunities as men hold the priesthood. There is a whole set of callings men can hold that women cannot hold, but the women have some of their own too. That doesn't seem doctrinal to me. Men hold the priesthood, but a worthy husband and wife share the priesthood together."
Her comment that husbands and wives share the priesthood is notably different from current language about priesthood, which emphasizes that women share in the blessings of it. A 34-year-old woman speaks of men and women's equality before God and uses the idea of gender difference to argue for greater equality in the lived lives of men and women in the church structure.
"I take the scripture that God is no respecter of persons very literally. I don't think that God gives a damn whether we are male or female. I think that he sees us as individuals, not as sexed bodies. But also I think, and this is so interesting because I'm informed by the church in this belief, that women and men are different. The church insists on this, insists. There's no room for us to argue that. In my mind, if women and men are different inherently, then we need to have both elements in leadership in order to have a full, functioning, healthy body. We need this in leadership in every aspect of the church body."
Another tactic that women use to internally deal with male hierarchy is to mentally dismiss teachings or policies that are problematic to them, to recognize the roles culture and human fallibility of leaders play in some policies and teachings from the church. There's the church organist who shakes her head at some of the rules separating men and women musicians in the church.
Fairly recently, we were told that it would no longer be possible to do four-handed accompaniments by a man and a woman on the same bench. I don't know where that came from, and I don't want to know.
There's the graduate student who sees fundamental contradictions on the church's teachings on gender and chalks these contradictions up to fallible leaders.
This is something I've never understood. How the church, out of one side of its mouth, can say that gender is eternal, and then out of the other side of its mouth, say that I need to teach you how to be a woman. That's just ridiculous in the extreme of my mind.
These are women who disagree with church policy / teachings, and they internally reconcile their disagreement by attributing these policy or teachings to human leaders who are doing their best, working according to their understanding, but falling short. There's a pragmatism here, an understanding that the church does not have infallible leaders. As one woman said,
discrimination happens in every church, in every culture. You can't expect leaders to be perfect.
And finally, one last internal strategy I saw women in these interviews taking in the face of their disagreement with church leadership was to retreat emotionally and spiritually from the church. This seemed to happen most often when the church was grappling with serious social issues of the day and, in the minds of some, coming up short. For one woman, it was the period in the 60s and 70s when blacks were denied the priesthood that was deeply distressing and nearly drove her to inactivity. For others, it was the women's movement in the 70s, which made them fundamentally question the church's judgment and guiding its people on these social issues. This 60-year-old woman describes her spiritual retreat from the church's campaign against ERA in this way.
I was not happy with what the church was doing, and I was not persuaded by the arguments or the assertions in their anti-ERA pamphlet, such that I thought, that's it. I continued to be Mormon, but in a very different way. Whereas before, when I was a child, I had questions like, this is true, but how is it true? It basically made me say, wait a second. Some of it might be true, and some might not be true. I had to start thinking about every single thing. I remember talking to a woman in my ward here, and she said, that's exhausting. Don't you think it's better to just accept it all? It's just too exhausting. I said I can't. Not anymore, and live with any kind of integrity.
In the oral histories I read, it was most often these social issues, these times when the church, in their minds, violated its own core teachings about equality, compassion, or agency, that was the most distressing and disillusioning. So far, I've been talking about some of the internal dynamics of what occurs when women contemplate their place in the gospel and in the church, or when there's some tension or disagreement with leaders. But now I want to examine the external dynamics. What do women do with this tension? How do they act when there are problems? The first trend I saw was something that I would call halfway measures. They halfway go along with the leadership, and they halfway don't. One way that women in these interviews did this was to register disagreement vocally, but go along half-heartedly. This woman, when her husband was called back into leadership, recounts telling her stake president this.
My boys have just gotten their father back, and you want to take him away again? The stake president said, we have boys, and my wife feels just like you do, but the Lord needs your husband. Can you support him in this? Yes, I said, through my tears.
She goes along, but she voices her pain, her sorrow, and her unhappiness with the situation. Another tactic in this halfway measures category is to split the difference in some way. You do what the leadership wants, but you also do what you want. That's what these women in Hawaii did when the Relief Society lost its financial autonomy. An 84-year-old woman recalls,
when the announcement was made about turning all our accounts over to the bishop, there was great consternation. Due to our earnings, we had a substantial bank account, but no particular needs for it, so it just built up to a large balance. The sister said, no, that's our money. We are not going to do that. I told them we had to turn it over. The reply, all right then, we'll spend it. The whole Relief Society decided to go into Honolulu to a nice restaurant and have an expensive buffet lunch. Two sisters were appointed to look over the restaurants in Honolulu to find the best buffet with large servings. I rounded up enough faculty women with cars who were willing to drive in and eat with us. The auto trip to the city was in itself a rare treat for most of the sisters who had no cars to take them anywhere. They dressed up in their colorful muumuus with large hibiscus flowers behind their ears and draped with many strands of heavy shell lace. It was truly a great event for them. They had the time of their lives. Personally, I was embarrassed because they stacked up their plates so high that I feared the food would fall off, but they ate every bite. They each had some of everything, spent every dollar, and were very happy.
Another tactic women used as they navigated teachings and policies they disagreed with was to push the envelope, to be proactive and creative in figuring out more inclusive ways to do things. This 60-year-old is a woman who takes the situation into her own hands, who comes to her leaders with new ideas and presents them. She knew when she married that she didn't want the temple sealer to
ruin my day by talking about the patriarchal order. My cousin was a sealer in the St. George Temple. We decided to get married in St. George, and I talked to my cousin, and I said, I want a woman to speak, to be part of the ceremony. He said, you're going to have to get the temple president's okay on that. So I went to the temple president's home and knocked on the door. He had been up since the 5:30 a.m. session, and was in a bathrobe on the sofa. I'd interrupted his nap, probably. But I asked, would you mind if we have a couple speak? This was our intention, a man and a woman. The temple president's response was, I can't see a reason why not. I mentioned my cousin, and he said to just make sure we didn't go over the time allotted. His concern was the timing in the sealing room. But the couple I had in mind weren't available that weekend, so I asked my friend Sharon, and she agreed. So she gave the talk at my wedding, and my cousin sealed us. I didn't have to listen to any of the patriarchal order stuff I'd long since rejected.
The same woman, again, in this next example, tried her best to work within the confines of church structure, but to push as far as she was able to for greater gender inclusion.
I spoke at my son's baptism and then stood up while they went into the font. I stood next to the font as my husband took him down, so there was some participation on my part. Then I stood by his side and held my son's hand when my husband confirmed him. We tried various things like this, and I worked with people. I was always thinking of other ways I could make things more inclusive.
Another woman likewise sees problems and just goes in and confronts her leaders about it.
I noticed a few years ago that for 3 weeks, there wasn't a single woman participating in sacrament meeting. No prayers, no speakers. The only ones were the chorister and the organist. So I went in and talked to my bishop and said, this is a problem. I explained to him that the church has an image problem when it comes to men and women, that we treat women as less than equal to men, and the least we can do is to try to make it apparent that women do have a role in the role to play in our worship services. He was very open and receptive. I saw a change after that.
In this example, this woman is particularly crafty in using ideas about public relations to argue for more gender inclusion. Another variation of this proactivity is a bit more subtle. I was struck in reading these oral histories just how much self-conscious finessing of their leaders some of these women did as they attempted to convince them of their point of view. A 34-year-old woman recounts this.
I've been fairly successful walking that line between speaking my mind and being embraced by my community. I've said things to men at church that could have made them look at me as a troublemaker, but I usually find a way to say them so that they have to acknowledge the truth of it. For example, my bishop in my last ward at BYU was telling all the girls that they needed to get their educations so that if something happened to their husbands, they'd be able to provide and help kids with schoolwork and all of the means to an end of getting an education. Rather than just telling him that that's BS, which I felt like doing, I found a way to couch it in terms of spiritual gifts and God giving us abilities and God expecting us to make the most of them. And I used the story of the servant who buried his talents, which were taken away. So I was able to couch what I was saying about education being something that women should pursue in and of itself, as an end of itself, in a way that was palatable. And he was able to say, yeah, you're right. Whenever I've been able to do that, I've had people, usually women, thank me for doing it.
Another woman likewise talks about self-consciously finessing her bishop in an attempt to get him to listen to her and understand where she was coming from spiritually. She says,
when a number of those women were running to the bishop to tell on me after I'd said something in Relief Society, I went to meet with the bishop. It was between general conference sessions that were being broadcast. I thought he'd probably be hungry, so I made him a sack lunch, because who can be mad at me if I do that? Is that manipulative? I don't know, but it was also thoughtful. So I said that I thought that maybe this conversation would be long and that I doubted he would have a chance to eat, so here's a sandwich. It did break down barriers. We talked. The discussion was really honest and friendly. But the irony is that he's the one who banned me from teaching. He was really apologetic about it because of the sandwich, I guess.
Patriarchy is not just a concept or a practice that Mormon women navigate in the church organization, as these last two women illustrated. With the proclamation of the family's emphasis on men presiding in the home, as well as various other teachings and scriptures that emphasize the same, it's also something that can have an effect on their marriages. In these oral histories, I noticed some women compensating for feelings of ambivalence with their place in the church by taking control where they could take control, in their own homes, in their own marriages.
I can't do much to make the church organization and structure more inclusive, but what I can do is to take control of my marriage and my life here in my house. So even though, in theory, my husband is supposed to be my presider in the home, I've made it clear that that doesn't happen. We've done our best to try to be egalitarian in all of our decision-making and practices. In no sense does his opinion on any matter have more weight than mine, and he certainly does not have the final say. We reject the idea that he is in some way a mediator between myself and God.
Another woman discusses the dynamics of her sister's marriage, highlighting her sister's forthright and assertive stances.
My sister decided several years ago that she didn't like what the birth control pill did to her body, so they would use condoms. Her friends all say that their husbands would refuse to use condoms. My sister's attitude is, well, does he want to have sex? If he does, then he'll accommodate my interests and needs as well. She sticks to her guns on things like that. Her husband understands that he's not the privileged one in the relationship that gets to make such determinations.
Sometimes, however, empowerment within marriage is not enough to solve the sting these women feel about their place in the church. So another tactic women used to deal with their ambivalence was to find communities of like-minded Mormons who were sympathetic to their concerns. These women spoke of finding dialogue, Sunstone, and Exponent 2. In the interest of time, I won't read much on this topic, but I will share this short quote, which shows just how much these communities meant to them.
I stayed in Mormonism because of those communities, whereas I might have jettisoned completely without them. I found a space where I could talk about things.
Finally, I saw women engaging in outright protest or overt disregard of leaders' instructions when they were confronted with teachings or instructions they disagreed with. This single parent recounts this.
At certain periods of my life, if I heard that women were to stay home, I'd get up and walk out of the church service. I did not feel that that was the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints that spoke to me. Families are important, but the structure of family varies, and especially today.
In another example, a Stake Relief Society president recounts an incident in which she simply ignores her area authority's instructions.
At one point, I submitted a request through the stake president, which then went to the area authority. I asked for Barbara Winder, the then Relief Society general president, to come to our women's conference and speak to our sisters. The area authority said no. Then he said that Barbara Winder and I probably knew each other. Certainly, she could not be invited because we probably knew each other. That didn't make any sense to me. Anyway, I went around to him and got her to come.
These last two quotes are for women who felt secure enough in their own judgment to outright ignore or protest statements that went against their understandings. So, final thoughts. What happens in the end? For most of the women I quoted here, they managed to find an equilibrium, a way to exist in the church, often quite happily, without being in a constant state of angst. They direct their energies to outside goals, they find solace in other communities, they grow accustomed to writing off certain church practices and ideas as unfortunate products of a traditional and patriarchal culture. I thought this woman articulated nicely that rough road to peace with the church.
I have hammered my own way to mostly peaceful living with the church, though when it comes along asking us to go door to door canvassing for Prop 8, I decline. When I get pushed like that, I start getting resistant. I cherish my free agency.
I liked her juxtaposition of hammering and peace. You can see the tension there. I also find it interesting that in the end she embraces her free agency and won't be pushed to be involved in things that she doesn't want to be involved in. Others, however, have found it impossible to live with integrity and maintain activity in the church. One of our women that I quoted tonight is largely inactive. For her, it's hard to go to church and live with integrity when the basic structure violates some of her core principles.
I still love some of the people in my ward. I have very good friends there, but increasingly, church is not a place that I find I am welcome. At least my ideas are not. The issue gets back to integrity and how I can be involved in a culture that demands certainty, that seems to demand devotion, when I'm increasingly at odds, politically and theologically, with many of the stands it takes. Also, I have trouble with the basic structure of the church. How can I be true to my conscience and yet support a structure that's patriarchal and excludes women? That's a huge issue for me. I know there are a number of people who just want to write me off. Oh, you're a feminist, you're just power hungry. And I think, no, it really is an issue for me. I'm not just being belligerent. I'm not just being prideful. All those things they accuse you of. I'm trying to live with integrity, and I can't fake belief. I just can't fake it.
Tonight I've shared the words of women who are steadfast and happy Mormons, despite the occasional run-in with church hierarchy, and women who have deeply struggled to find their place in the organization. While these women may ultimately end up in different places, some active, some inactive, some semi-active, a common thread that weaves all these women together is a conviction of the importance of agency and the importance of integrity. These two concepts, so fundamentally Mormon, undergird all their various decisions to agree or disagree with leaders, to ignore or follow church dictates. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your attention. We appreciate it. Good night.
A couple quick announcements. I forgot to mention at the beginning that as part of Sunstone's outreach efforts, we have started a Sunstone student group at the University of Utah, and we're hoping to branch out to other universities around the Wasatch Front. So if you know a University of Utah student who might be interested, send them our way, and any other students on other Utah campuses who might want to keep a Sunstone connection going. The office staff has recovered from this event with a week off / coma. We are planning some other lectures and gatherings at the Sunstone office this fall, and you can look for updates about those events and details on Sunstone's webpage and Facebook page. I just wanted to thank you all again for your support and your presence at this event. There's an incomparable energy when we all get together and spend time with each other. We get to make connections. We share meals together. There's the opportunity to meet a favorite blogger or a scholar whose work you admire. And for many people, there's a real feeling of family here where they might not have an experience like that necessarily in their ward. And when we get to see each other more often than just at this big Sunstone event in Salt Lake, we feel very fortunate about that. If you're not ready yet to part company, you'll see in your Sunstone program an invitation to services tomorrow at the Salt Lake Community of Christ building beginning at 10 a.m. Is that correct? Yes. Sunday school, a lecture on restoration tradition, and a communion service, I believe, and lunch. Okay, Joseph, the presentation that Locke McCabe gave on Joseph Smith III, which describes. Okay, yeah, all right. So look for the details in your program, and that will be followed by lunch. And if you have the stamina for it, there is also an after party at Karen Maloney's home on Capitol Hill. Folks gather on her back deck, share snacks, and talk about their favorite sessions, the sessions that got them provoked, interested, energized, and things like that. So the details of how to get to her home are also in the Sunstone program. We will look forward to seeing you again in Salt Lake next summer. The Sheraton is going to be setting up a webpage for our Salt Lake Symposium 2011. I'm sorry, it's late. It's been a long week for me. Sunstone 2011. So that will have details about our event, reserving sleeping rooms at the hotel, and other things. And we'll also post additional details on our website and Facebook page as they become available. We will close this evening with a... Oh, my husband's holding up a box in the back where we will be happy to recycle your badges so they don't end up in the trash or a landfill somewhere. So we again thank you for coming, and Sue Stevens will give our closing prayer.
Our Father, in this hour we bow our heads again before Thee, particularly to give thanks for these days that we've come together and for these 2 hours tonight. We acknowledge Thy hand in our lives and are grateful for the influence of Thy Spirit. We ask a benediction now as this evening comes to a close on this incredible gathering. We're grateful for the fellowship that it provides and the kinship. We recognize, Father, that when Thy Spirit is with us, we are home, no matter where it is. And we give thanks, pray for those who are less fortunate, and ask for guidance in our lives, that we might know where to turn and where to reach out and where to give the handship of fellowship. Acknowledging these things before Thee, we ask for continuing blessings as Thou seest fit, and do it in the name of Thy Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen.